Listen, there's a great work to be done. As soon as you win this court battle, you must deliver this message. Take advantage of this opportunity and declare a powerful message to this world. He expects more of us. He believes we can do more. Who's going to stop Christ? Who's going to stop Christ from getting this work done?
This is Behind the Work.
Welcome to Behind the Work. I'm Grant Turgeon. We're broadcasting to you live this morning from the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus here in Edmond, Oklahoma, on the first Monday after daylight saving time. And you already know that I overslept a little bit this morning. It seems like that's a tradition, a dubious tradition for me. Thankfully, things have gotten worked out, but it's a little bit more difficult for the body clock to adjust, at least for a couple days, especially when it's dark, even at 8 o'clock when work is starting. But we're here now. Everything is good. Well, the last time we talked about the life of the late educator and theologian Herbert W. Armstrong, we were discussing him helping his brother-in-law win a speaking competition. He was recognized as the best speaker in the entire state of Iowa, at least of all those who were entered in this competition. But after that, Mr. Armstrong was still in a bit of a rut work-wise, and his wife convinced him to drive all the way up to Oregon, uproot their lives, and restart all the way out there in the Pacific Northwest. And I just wanted to take a moment to hopefully remind you to be grateful for the way that we travel today, because their trip lasted from June 16th, 1924, until July 3rd, just to drive from Iowa to Oregon. And they were bumping up and down on gravel roads and getting stuck on muddy roads. Their daughter lost a shoe. Their daughter also had a horrible spider bite on her arm. They were sleeping in tent cities all along the way because this was before they had hotels. There was a tent that attached to the side of their car. And then they had these makeshift cots that Mr. Armstrong made for them to sleep on, but then those broke partway through the trip. So they all had to sleep on the ground, and it was so cold during the nights that they had to huddle together on the same bedding. It's certainly nice that we don't have to just plod along at about 20 miles per hour on the highway anymore. They were driving probably about 12 hours every single day from 6 a.m. until just about sunset so that they'd have time to set up their camp. And every time it rained, obviously, that would greatly impact their sleeping arrangements, too. The cars didn't really have an enclosed area for them to sit, so they actually had to pin up the doors, basically like curtains for doors, when it was raining. Very blessed that we have advancements in our abilities to travel now. Just think back then, you probably couldn't really travel and see the country. Even being from America, the greatest nation on earth, you'd probably pretty much only be aware of your small part of the country, not having seen almost any of the rest of it. So Mr. Armstrong takes his wife, his two daughters, and also his wife's brother and sister up to Oregon with him on this drive. And finally they make it. Mr. Armstrong realizes, once he sees his father again up in Oregon, how much smarter his father had suddenly become. But actually, his father had always been pretty smart. It was just that when Mr. Armstrong was a teen, he thought he knew it all. When he was a bit older, he understood how much experience and wisdom his father really had. Along this trip, Mr. Armstrong was getting different survey jobs along the way. that would help him make a little bit of money to sustain them and hopefully get them all the way up to Oregon. But at one point, they ran out of money, and his father had to wire him some money there. But it wasn't long before Mr. Armstrong did pretty solidly establish himself up in the Pacific Northwest. He did, because of his business acumen, because of his rigorous self-study, his lifelong learning process, make himself quite valuable. He did establish inroads into the advertising field up there. And eventually it became specific to these laundry companies. In Washington State and in Oregon, he was representing a number of the leading laundromats in these different cities. But here again is just an example of how Mr. Armstrong was an honest advertiser. He said that he would accept no laundromat as a client unless this laundry owner would agree to install the latest scientific methods and equipment, eliminate lost motion, and speed up efficiency. In chapter 15 of the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong, Mr. Armstrong writes, "I had to be able to make big claims in advertising. The client had to be able to deliver what the ads promised. The client had to agree to settle every claim without a question. The customer was always to be right in any complaint." Mr. Armstrong had quite a challenge here, because even though the laundromat business was 12th largest in the United States at the time, Mr. Armstrong believed that they were pretty much the most dead when it came to their advertising. And because of this, misconceptions about the business abounded. Pretty much all mothers believed that if they put their clothes in the laundromat, they would come back shrunken and discolored and damaged. Even though these women hadn't had personal experiences like that necessarily, it's just what they all believed. So Mr. Armstrong had to embark on a campaign of changing minds. You see this as a common theme in the autobiography. He really did know how to change minds, how to win minds. So Mr. Armstrong basically has this syndicated advertising campaign where all these different laundromats in all these different cities would be running similar ads, and then he would just personalize each one slightly. But because he knew that they were all up to the right standard, he could make confident generalized claims about all of those laundromats at once. Remember, when he was in Chicago, he had an ad agency that fell apart because of the Great Depression. By forces beyond his control, he was thrown into poverty. And now he's building up another business that should pretty much make him the equivalent of a millionaire today. But then he writes, "And then the bottom fell out." Again, Mr. Armstrong picks himself up and builds up pretty impressive success in the business world, only to have it all fall apart. How devastating this must have been. Now, the reason this happened was because all of these laundromats were represented by a Laundry Owners National Association. And when this association agreed to another ad campaign that would take up pretty much the entire advertising budget of every individual laundromat, all of the clients for Mr. Armstrong pretty much had no choice. They were forced by their association to go along with this different advertising campaign, and then they had no money left for their business with Mr. Armstrong. Absolutely nothing Mr. Armstrong could have done about this to prevent, yet again, his business from collapsing. He writes here, "Now with a new business of much greater promise, all my clients were suddenly removed from possibility of access through powers and forces entirely outside of my control. It seemed indeed as if some invisible and mysterious hand were causing the earth to simply swallow up whatever business I started." What a helpless feeling here. To know that he had worked as hard as he possibly could and done all of the self-study and developed the skills that he needed to excel in business, only for everything to keep collapsing on him like this. You could imagine just how hard this must have been for Mr. Armstrong and what he must have been thinking at this time. What is he supposed to do? He has a wife and two daughters to support. And yet every time he starts to establish the family to be comfortable financially, it falls apart. And then, to make everything worse, Mr. Armstrong's wife came to him with a perplexing challenge. She said, "If you can prove by the Bible that Christians are commanded to observe Sunday, then of course I'll do what I see in the Bible." So Mrs. Armstrong had always been pretty religious, but because of her husband's influence, they hadn't been as involved at church. But here Mrs. Armstrong had just had a Bible study with a neighbor lady named Mrs. Ora Runcorn. And all this lady did was tell Mrs. Armstrong to turn to these different scriptures and read them out loud. She didn't try to present her own belief. She just let Mrs. Armstrong read those verses for herself. And then Mrs. Armstrong was convinced that God commands us to worship him on the Sabbath. Of course, she thought her husband would be thrilled to find out this exciting new truth, but he wasn't. This had to have been the worst possible timing for this subject to be brought up, at least in Mr. Armstrong's mind. He didn't want to be ridiculed for being different. He didn't want to observe the Sabbath. He didn't even want to admit that it was the right day. Because as we've seen from Mr. Armstrong, if he knows that something is right, he's going to do it. So he doesn't even want to entertain the question. He doesn't even want to look into it at all, because then he'll have to obey. So just horrendous timing for this challenge from his wife. And Mr. Armstrong, being the unique man he was, actually told his wife that he would study really hard into it, and he would do what it took to prove his wife wrong. By this time, it was the fall of 1926. He only had one advertising account left for a laundromat in Portland, Oregon, so he had plenty of time to go to the library and study it all day until the library closed, and then go home and study it for half the night until his wife begged him to come to bed. Practically 17 or 18, maybe up to 20 hours of study every day, all day, every day for 6 months. And as Mr. Armstrong called it, "It was an in-depth study of the Bible for the first time in my life." Chapter 16 of the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong is titled "Researching the Bible and Darwin." So it's not just one challenge. As you'll see here, he actually was confronted again on a different subject. This is from his brother-in-law Walter's new wife, Hertha. She said, Herbert Armstrong, you are simply ignorant. One is uneducated and ignorant unless he believes in evolution. All educated people now believe it. Mr. Armstrong was already reeling from his wife's challenge, only to have another relative challenge him on a different topic. But even back then, Mr. Armstrong could actually see how these things were related. The Sabbath requires that you prove God's existence so that you can prove that he commands the Sabbath. Evolution demands that you actually disbelieve in God altogether. So by proving the Sabbath true, you would prove evolution false, or vice versa. Mr. Armstrong replied to Hertha's challenge, "I'm going to make you eat those words." I just think of him saying that just with a lot of energy and force and indignation, and it always makes me laugh there. He said that this is the study into the two possibilities of origins. So you have to get into the most basic, fundamental, foundational study to prove God exists and thereby prove the Sabbath and then disprove evolution. But remember, Mr. Armstrong didn't want to actually prove the Sabbath true. He did want to prove that God existed. He did want to disprove evolution. But he was going to go into this study with an open mind and just let the facts fall where they may. Mr. Armstrong, remember, educated himself. He didn't go to a university. He wasn't brainwashed like his poor relative, Hertha. And because he had the discipline and the drive to educate himself, he was the rare kind of a man who would actually partake in this rare double study. The Sabbath question and the evolution question, which really do get back to this study of origins. Does God exist? Did he create the entire earth and the universe and human beings and plants and animals? Or did all of this just come about by a dumb process known as evolution? This would really seem like a daunting study to most people. And yet, Mr. Armstrong eagerly attacked it. It's easy to understand why God could use him so powerfully later in his life. Because he hungered for instruction and knowledge. He wanted to understand the truth. Even if sometimes knowing the truth meant that he had to make some hard changes in his life. So he dug into science, and he very much did disprove evolution and prove the existence of God. He learned about radioactive elements and how radioactivity proves that matter, physical substance, has not always existed. There was a definite moment in time where matter appeared. And when that matter appeared, you could call it creation. This is a proof of God. He also learned by the law of biogenesis that only life can beget life. So you could go back to the tiniest particle of matter, but if that particle is alive, where did it come from? It couldn't have popped out of nothing. It couldn't have come from something that's not alive. Life has to come from life. It can't come from dead matter. Even scientists acknowledge this. And yet, they're so much in rebellion against God that they won't admit it. They won't admit that there has to be a creator. there had to be a living, creative, powerful being to make even the tiniest particle of matter exist. Mr. Armstrong also looked into the Bible, because the Bible is the one book that actually makes a pretty stunning statement. The Bible says, "I am God." It's quoting a being who actually proclaims to be in charge of every event that has ever taken place in history. A being who decides the fate of nations. The Bible makes this claim. Other books are not so dogmatic. So Mr. Armstrong looked into this situation here with the Bible and all these different times where God said, "I am God," and he guaranteed that certain events were going to take place. And he proved that these events took place, that God did fulfill these prophecies. You've heard the term self-fulfilling prophecy, where if you say something is going to happen, but you have total control and you make sure that it happens, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, that's what prophecies are to God. He can say that something is going to happen on this planet, and then he actually has the power to make it come true. No human being could do that like he does on that scale. And that is another proof of God. Fulfilled prophecy proves not only God, but also that the Bible is his inspired word. Mr. Armstrong decisively disproved evolution. He looked into the theories of those like Charles Darwin, who died unsure of his own theory. He was clearly a mentally disturbed individual, and that really did discolor a lot of what he researched. Mr. Armstrong looked into the matter of the human mind. If evolution is really true, how could you possibly bridge the gap between animals and the human mind? It would take so many billions and trillions of years for that to actually happen. And of course, trillions of years is far longer than what you could ever prove through geology or paleontology. Earth simply hasn't existed that long. No scientist would possibly tell you that the Earth has existed for trillions of years, and yet they would still claim that we came from animals. How do you possibly account for the vast superiority of the human mind over the animal brain? It would simply take way too long for animals to somehow develop all of our capabilities. It doesn't mesh with the evolutionary hypothesis. And Mr. Armstrong also used a lot of logic in his study. He knows that we, as human beings, are creators. We can create things. But think about the greatest thing you've ever created. Maybe you have built some sort of a technological device. Or maybe you've baked a beautiful cake. I haven't done anything close to either of those things. But just think about your creation. Is it better than you? Could you ever say that the cake that you planned and designed and cooked or baked is better than you? Of course not. Our human mind is also greater than anything we could ever create. There has to be a creator of vastly superior mind power to us who had to create it. And that's another proof of God. Another disproof, if you could call it that, of evolution. But you see here how Mr. Armstrong attacked this subject from every possible angle. And he did prove that God existed. He proved through science itself. There's usually a pretty common accusation today that is thrown out there against political conservatives, but also against people who are religious. And it's that those people are anti-science. But the fact is, the Bible, religion, doesn't have to be at war with science. The Bible only reinforces the truth of what science has uncovered. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It doesn't have to be religion or science. It can be both, at least when it comes to true religion. So after Mr. Armstrong disproved evolution and proved the existence of the Creator, he then had to get into this Sabbath question. God clearly has authority, so if he does command Sabbath observance, Mr. Armstrong realized he would have to agree with that and obey that. But he couldn't find a single instance in the entire Bible where the word Sunday is written. He couldn't find an instance where God's people observe Sunday, because those instances don't exist in the Bible at all. In fact, Christ and Paul customarily kept the Sabbath. It was their manner. It was their habit. They kept the Sabbath because God commands it. They didn't keep Sunday. The Sabbath is actually an identifying sign between God and us. And so Mr. Armstrong proved all of this. He understood the beauty of the Sabbath day, how God sets it apart for holy use, how it is a space of time every single week where we can connect with Him. We can lay aside all of our other concerns, our fears, our worries, even our physical desires, and we can focus on Him. All of our power to live the right way of life comes from Him, and the Sabbath really helps a lot with that. Mr. Armstrong learned about law and how God praises the law in the Bible. The law is spiritual. The law is perfect. So why would God do away with it? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. God certainly would ascribe to that. So Mr. Armstrong was humiliated in front of his wife. He did have to admit to her that God commands Sabbath observance, but he did have the satisfaction of telling Hertha to eat her words. So today we've been talking about the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong, how Mr. Armstrong is finally being knocked down and humbled and proving God's truth for himself. And this is really the start of a life transformation for him. He is really going to experience the fullness and the riches of God from this point forward. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Grant Turgeon. This has been Behind the Work.
You've been listening to Behind the Work. Email your thoughts to comments at kpcg.fm. Listen for a new episode each Monday at 11:30 a.m. Central Time.